Coming Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th, Issues Etc. 24. It's a live 24-hour Bible study from 4 in the afternoon Central Time on April 8th through 4 in the afternoon Central on April 9th. Issues Etc. 24. Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th. Listen live at issuesetc.org.
So often those contemporary issues are used to polarize. We see them as calling us together to convene. Our unity is within our diversity.
That's just nonsense. Of course, if you have diversity on key core Christian teachings and doctrines, you've got big time problems.
Paul Fitness for Jesus. I do feel a spiritual connection whenever you have the music on and it's singing about lifting you up and being closer to God. You do feel that.
Pop American Christianity, in an ill-fated attempt to get the gospel out, has really asked the world what it wants.
Washington jet drivers love Issues Etc.
There's no doubt that there has been a pushback in the States against 35 plus years of legalized abortion in the United States. There's no doubt that of late, in the last decade or so, there have been more and more regulations and laws passed state by state about abortion, dealing with abortion, parental notification, this type of thing, restricting funding for abortion through Medicaid, that type of thing. Has it made a difference? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, April the 5th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk with Dr. Michael New of the University of Alabama about state abortion laws and abortion rates. A little bit later in this hour, Alan Wisdom will join us to talk about the battle in the Presbyterian Church USA over openly homosexual pastors. And Dr. Gene Edward Veith of Patrick Henry College will be our guest for the last half hour. We'll remember on this day, the two men remembered by the church tomorrow, 16th century Reformation artists Lucas Cranach and Albrecht Dürer. If you don't know the names, I'm sure you have seen their art. We'll also talk about Christianity and the arts with Dr. Veith a little later in this hour, live this Tuesday, April the 6th. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. You can also email us, talkback at issuesetc.org, or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Michael New is assistant professor of political science at the University of Alabama and author of a recent study titled Analyzing the Effects of Anti-Abortion U.S. State Legislation in the Post-Casey Era. Michael, welcome to Issues Etc.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Things like parental involvement laws, have they made a difference in the abortion rates?
Yeah, they've actually made quite a substantial difference. One story that you won't hear from the mainstream media is that the abortion rate amongst minors fell by about 50% between 1985 and 1999. That meant a teen girl in the late 90s was half as likely as her counterpart 15 years ago to have had an abortion. And there's many reasons for this. I mean, one important thing is that, you know, minors are a little bit less likely to engage in sexual activity, and that's certainly a good thing. But these laws have had an impact that we've seen about, during the 90s, about 10 to 15 more states have enacted these pro-life parental involvement laws that require parents to either be notified before their daughter gets an abortion or require the parents to give consent before their daughter can get an abortion. And we see pretty consistently that when states go ahead and pass these laws, minor abortions drop by about 15%. Obviously, they don't stop every abortion, but they do stop some. They do protect the unborn and minor girls, and there's something the pro-life movement should continue to pursue.
So why is it, if both sides on the abortion debate seem to believe that abortion, to use the terminology of the pro-choice side, should be safe, legal, and rare, if both sides agree on the rare part of that formula, why do pro-choice forces continue to oppose state abortion laws and regulations?
I think that this, the reality doesn't really match the rhetoric with a lot of these people. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, you know, the Democratic Party gets a substantial amount of, you know, money from the multi-billion-dollar abortion industry. I think they really do contrary what they the rhetoric indicates. You know, I think they do have an interest in, seeing to it that abortion numbers, maintain at a steady number. I always do find find it puzzling that even kind of the most common sense restrictions, even restrictions on very late-term abortions, even laws that would pertain to 13, 14-year-old minor girls who, under most circumstances, would never be allowed to make decisions about their health care. The other side opposes these quite vigorously, and it's disappointing.
How would you respond to the assertion that abortion is really an issue of poverty and of class, and it requires an increase in welfare benefits, and then we could see the rates drop?
That's interesting, and some people have made that argument. But at the end of the day, there's just really no peer-reviewed evidence that really support that indicates that spending more money on welfare programs does anything to reduce abortion. A number of people and some Democrats have made that argument, but I cannot cite even one single peer-reviewed study which says that spending more money on welfare gets abortion numbers down. There's many, many studies that say if you cut off public funding for abortion, abortion numbers go down. If you require parental involvement, abortion numbers go down, but nothing about welfare as such. Now, the pro-life movement is, I think, a lot more ideologically diverse than people realize. People in the pro-life movement have different opinions about, what kind of public welfare provision, the government ought to provide for our low-income earners. And, we all do support, crisis pregnancy centers, that do offer material support for pregnant women. They've very quietly have done an excellent job providing alternatives to women who have not wanted to seek abortions. We applaud that. But when it really comes down to it, there's really no real evidence that spending more money on welfare does much of anything to stop abortion.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, this is good news, but the news could be better, and if the resources and the energy used to pass state-by-state laws in a kind of incremental approach to restricting access to abortion were applied to overturning Roe v. Wade entirely, maybe we could see a better situation. How do you respond?
Well, I think that Roe versus Wade put the pro-life movement in a very difficult position, that there's not a tremendous amount we can do at the state level. There are some things we can do. We can cut off public funding. We can pass parental involvement laws. We can pass informed consent laws, which require that women seeking abortions to get information about things like fetal development and source of support. And if the Supreme Court has allowed us to do that, we should take advantage of those opportunities. Obviously, we have tried to overturn Roe versus Wade. We haven't necessarily pursued purely a local or a state angle. Unfortunately, we haven't really had the best of luck in getting sort of Supreme Court justices on the court that would be likely to overturn Roe. I was heartened that President Bush did appoint people like Samuel Alito and John Roberts. I think they are strict constructionists. I think there's at least a decent chance they would vote to overturn Roe, or at least, if not overturn Roe, give states even more power to restrict abortion. But essentially, we have to pursue this on many fronts, both locally, and kind of the national level, and even doing things that aren't political, educating our friends and our peers, changing the culture, supporting crisis pregnancy centers. We need to kind of pursue this battle on many fronts, but I think that kind of incremental laws are an important front that we should keep working on.
What state, in your opinion, or states, are leading the way in terms of laws that would help reduce abortion rates?
I think the state that's probably been the most active is Mississippi. I think Mississippi is a really good case study of what incremental laws can do. In Mississippi right now, there's only one abortion provider left in the entire state. They're located in Jackson, Mississippi. The numbers of providers have gone down. In Mississippi, they've almost regulated abortion kind of out of existence. They have one of the best parental involvement laws. In fact, the only parental involvement law that requires that two parents must give consent for their minor daughter to have an abortion. They have one of the best informed consent laws that requires that women seeking abortions, make two separate trips to a clinic and have a waiting period in between that. They've basically done an excellent job passing a lot of very good protective laws. The abortion numbers have gone down, and they're down to only one abortion clinic left in the entire state. So I think they're probably the best case study of what you can do with incremental laws.
I mean, someone is going to say, sure, Mississippi has virtually eliminated abortion in its boundaries, but it's managed to just maybe bolster the numbers in nearby states where people can go. They're just leaving Mississippi to get abortions. Your response?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, these laws are only limited to the, the states they're enacted in. And yeah, I'm sure there are women from Mississippi who do cross state borders to get abortions in other states. But keep in mind, I think that's just sort of a good reason for other states to do the same thing and, pass equally good protective laws. And essentially, if, the longer the distance they have to travel, they may reconsider. And, I mean, you can also look at, there are statistics both on abortions based on, residence and occurrence. And I think that, if you do just look at the number of abortions performed on Mississippi residents, regardless of where they're actually taking place, numbers have in fact gone down. And to keep in mind, there are certain kinds of laws that people wouldn't just escape the state to avoid. For instance, public funding restrictions. You can't really go to another state to get a publicly funded abortion. That you have to be enrolled in your own state's Medicaid program to be eligible. And if your state cuts off funding, you can't go to another state. Informed consent laws just give women information about, again, you know, public and private sources of support, information about health risks. And I really don't see women, you know, going to another state just to avoid getting that information. So in some cases, yeah, women can cross state borders, but other states, I think these restrictions are having an impact that, you know, is being felt within that state.
Finally, then, make the case. Why are state anti-abortion laws good for our society as a whole? 1 minute, Michael.
Sure. I mean, I think that unfortunately we can't ban abortion and protect all unborn children, but we can, you know, place certain limitations on abortion. And I think, you know, these limitations have been effective at protecting the unborn, and I think sparing countless thousands, if not millions, of women from a lifetime of regret of going through an abortion, which they might later regret someday. Again, unfortunately, wish we could do more faster. Number of abortions has fallen by about 25% since 1990. I think these laws have played a big role in this decline, but overall they've been effective at both protecting unborn children and their mothers.
Dr. Michael New is assistant professor of political science at the University of Alabama, author of a recent study titled Analyzing the Effects of Anti-Abortion U.S. State Legislation in the Post-Casey Era. Dr. New, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
When we come back, Alan Wisdom's going to join us from the Institute on Religion and Democracy based in Washington, D.C. The Presbyterian Church USA is among the oldest Protestant denominations in the United States. It's not the largest any longer, but 11,000 congregations and about 2.3 million people as a member. They have tried several times to get openly gay clergy approved across this denomination and have failed. They're trying for the fourth time. We'll talk about that battle over openly homosexual pastors in the PCUSA with Alan Wisdom after this.
Coming Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th, Issues Etc. 24. It's a live 24-hour Bible study from 4 in the afternoon Central Time on April 8th through 4 in the afternoon Central on April 9th. Issues Etc. 24. Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th. Listen live at issuesetc.org.
What does God's Word teach about prayer, the Holy Spirit, baptism, angels and demons, the Lord's Supper, creation, marriage and family, predestination, and the end times? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Lutheran Difference. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase The Lutheran Difference by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, The Lutheran Difference.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The beautiful shoreline, the calming sound of Lake Michigan, the glorious sunrise, the warm June afternoons. This is Wisconsin Lakeshore Luther Hostel on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin, June 11th through the 14th, 2011. The program? Dr. Paul L. Meyer, professor of history at Western Michigan University and frequent guest on Issues Etc. The topic? The Crescent and the Cross. Islam and Christianity. Dr. Meyer will cover the historical background of Muhammad, the rise of Islam around the world, the beliefs and practices of this world religion, and what its future may hold. In addition, the four-day, three-night Luther Hostel includes interesting day trips to area attractions. For details how you can register for Wisconsin Lakeshore Luther Hostel, sponsored by the Concordia Bible Institute on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin, visit the Concordia Bible Institute website at www.concordiabible.org or phone 262-243-4343.